KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
It's 10:04.
The history of Afghanistan is not invasions, occupations, and interventions. It has a story of its own, which is often interrupted by invasions, occupations, and interventions.
I think just piling up rocks, you don't necessarily need to make a pretty and perfect cairn.
Pike Place is not textbook beautiful or textbook accessible.
We're going to talk this hour on weekday about what makes a walkable city. We'll look at Pike Place as an example of what works and what doesn't. We're also going to talk about cairns, which many of you use in hiking the backcountry or maybe wandering the city or just wandering the Shilshil shore. We're going to talk about the meaning of cairns. But we start with a look at Afghanistan and the history of Afghanistan and its future. Tamim Ansari is a writer, a lecturer, an editor, a teacher. He's the author of West of Kabul, East of New York, and his current book is Game Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
He's going to be at Town Hall tomorrow night at 7:30 talking about these issues. I would like to start with today's news, and then we'll go back in time a little bit. Because just today, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, everybody's now saying, what's the plan after 2014? The surge troops pulled out, the combat troops pulled out. What's the plan for Afghanistan by NATO and the U.S.? Is that the right question to ask?
Well, it's a question to ask. even when I came back from Afghanistan last spring, the one thing I knew was that we were not actually pulling out completely. But I think the plan really is to reduce the military footprint of the United States and NATO in Afghanistan, which is a good thing. The garrisons in Afghanistan, Bagram Airport, which is actually now a city, and some of these other bases, those are under the process of still being constructed. So I think there is a plan to stay in some form or fashion. I think Afghans are looking ahead with trepidation. I will say that, I sold my father's land this year to a fellow in Kabul, and I said, are you going to move in? He said, no, I'm going to rent it for 2 years. I said, how come? He said, because I'm a Tajik, and that's a Hazara neighborhood, and I don't want to be the only Tajik in a Hazara neighborhood on the day that NATO withdraws. So there is that kind of trepidation. On the other hand, the common assumption that the minute the last visible NATO troop is gone, there's going to be an ethnic war. I don't think that's a done deal at all. We don't exactly know what's going to happen.
But you still fear it somewhat.
I fear it somewhat because the contradictions within Afghan society have not by any means been ironed out yet.
What about a Taliban resurgence? I mean, a Taliban war taking over the government in Kabul.
Well, the view that I have is that all of the conversation about the military campaign in Afghanistan is premised on the idea that there is a distinct group we might call the Afghans and there is some distinct other that we, for convenience, refer to as the Taliban. But my experience is that actually Talibanism is one end of a continuum in Afghan society. And it definitely is. There's an extreme and jihadist and radical and militant and highly reprehensible extreme. But that's a continuum that comes all the way to the other extreme, which is Western-oriented, secularizing, developmentalist, Western-allied, former elite, now re-ensconced in Afghanistan. And in between, it's not like there's just a gap. There's all Afghans of all stripes. So the question after withdrawal is, will it divide into the two extremes? Will it integrate? What's going to happen? It's more a question of what will happen with the society.
Where's Karzai in that spectrum you just laid out? Where's Hamid Karzai and his supporters?
Well, Hamid Karzai has certainly remained in office these several years. Because he's the person who is associated with America, or rather the person who has American support. So in that sense, he's at the extreme end, opposite what we're calling the Taliban. On the other hand, he's been so, he's made so much effort in these few years to try to put out the feelers that I'm not that guy. One of these days I could join the Taliban. And in saying that, I want to point out that that would not be like in the old days when the Soviets were in town, someone saying, maybe I'll join the Soviets. That would be a completely different kind of statement in Afghan society, whereas someone who says, maybe I'll join the Taliban, is addressing Afghans and saying, maybe I will be more conservative, socially repressive on women and so on and so forth. And there is a constituency for that in Afghan society.
He might get the votes he needed, just like Mitt Romney tried to get those votes in the same way, huh?
Well, I would say voting is probably not going to be the...
That's not how it would come about.
That's not how it's going to be decided.
Amir Tamim Ansari is an Afghan-American author, public speaker. He was born in Afghanistan, lived there until high school, and he won a scholarship to Colorado Rocky Mountain School. Is that right?
Yes, I did.
And then he went to Reed College.
I did.
You are a Reedy.
I'm a Reedy. A proud Reedy.
A proud Reedy. What would walking down the streets of, let's say, Kandahar,
yeah,
if you could, what would they think of a proud Reedy like yourself, the folks who would walk up to you?
Well, the first thing is they wouldn't know I was a Reedy.
Well, you know, you have the big sweatshirt on.
I will say that in Kabul and in central Afghanistan, which is the two places I was in this spring when I was in Afghanistan, you know, the way I dress, people would look at me, the way I look, the way my stance, from a distance, people would look at me and say, oh, there's one of those Westerners. When they came up to me, the moment that they spoke to me, I have I don't have an accent. I speak Dari fluently. The minute they heard my language, they'd go, oh, you're one of us. And I would have fun sometimes. You know, they'd come up to me and say, hello, sir, how are you? And then in Farsi or Dari, I'd say, you don't speak Dari?
One of us. What does that mean in Afghanistan, to be one of us?
Means you're Afghan, you're Muslim, you're from around here, you know, that's just a general sort of thing. Now, I will say I have not been to Kandahar in these times. Part of my childhood was spent near Kandahar. Kandahar is a very different kind of city. Even before all this stuff, there was a little bit of a feeling of you're either a Kabuli or a Kandahari. So I don't know what it's like there now.
This book that you've written, Game Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan, is about the history of this place. And as you put it at one point, it's often a history that has the Afghan or Afghan leaders or Afghan tribal chieftains looking up and finding themselves between two Western armed factions and trying to figure out what to do.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the beginning of not Afghanistan, but the places there, mm-hmm, before it became Afghanistan. What kind of place was it for... an entrepreneur, somebody who wanted to do something in the 1500s. I mean, they had Silk Road trade coming through. You had opportunity, right?
Well, if you mean commercial opportunities, yes.
I don't know.
Yeah. There's industrial opportunities and there's commercial opportunities. So Afghanistan was a trade center, merchants were a feature of Afghan society. And Afghan society, there were feudal cities and they had healthy bazaars. Much of the population, however, were not city folk. They were distributed across the landscape and they lived in villages or they lived in and around these structures called qalas or fortresses, which were dominated by perhaps one big landowner and his relatives and what do you call them? Their dependents.
What was their ethnic background? Was it like it is today? Were there Tajiks and Pashtos and the like, or were there different people there at that time?
No, they were those people. Even though I would say at a certain point, the Pashtuns are famously people who have this code of generosity and, you know, you must avenge your relative's death and so on. There's a certain sense in which many of those tenets are characteristic of the way of life of the various people in that group, even other ethnic groups. So I think, you know, most, it doesn't matter if you're Hazara, Tajik, or Pashtun. If a guest comes, you try to do everything you can to, you know, your generosity should not go, should be legendary when they leave. They should talk about it.
Was it a rich country? I don't mean, was it a rich country? Was it a wealthy country then in term, because they were part of the trade routes?
There were rich cities in the past, yes. Specifically the ones in the north. The city of Balkh at one time was an incredible entrepot of trade between Rome and China, really, and India. I wouldn't say it was a wealthy country. I mean, that comes and goes, you know. It's when the Afghanistan area was the center of world historical stuff, then the city of Kabul, the city of Herat, the city of Balkh, Mazar-e-Sharif, other associated cities, those were rich places, yes.
How do you look at the British era? So up into the 1800s, how did that shape the Afghanistan we know today?
Well, I think the British era is when the impulse of Afghan history, which until then had been if a charismatic conqueror arose in that area, he would gather his forces and go out conquering. That's what they did. And they didn't concern themselves too much with deepening their control of their subjects. They pretty much let them do what they wanted. Their aim was to extend the territory over which they could say, I am the king of all this. Once the British and the Russians came, they couldn't do that anymore. They were turned back by these stone walls of global powers. And then Afghanistan, the next time that impulse arose, it turned inward. And there began a process of Afghan elite, Afghan rulers trying to conquer their own people.
Give me an example of that from that era, from the 1700s, 1800s.
Well, in 1880, the British handed over Afghanistan to a strongman. They handed it over because, man, they could not govern the place, and it was just more trouble than it was worth.
Because of that inward turning?
More because the presence of the British in Afghanistan rendered it less governable than it had been before. The only governance that would succeed in Afghanistan was by somebody who was recognized as culturally familiar. So when the British came, Afghan society fragmented, violence became endemic, and they could not govern it. They could not control it, and they could not function there. So they just said, listen, all we really want is for you guys to keep the Russians out. Will you do that? Yeah, okay, here's the country. You can have it.
So did you just write the parallel for what is happening today with NATO and the U.S. forces?
Does it not sound somewhat familiar? Yes.
Just keep the Taliban before. Out in this
yeah.
case, right?
Yeah, actually, that's what they're saying. And really, what they should be saying is keep al-Qaeda out, because al-Qaeda is also, you know, there's many groups that are of that nature. But when you say that, you're referring to a global revolutionary jihadist thing. When you say Taliban, you're back inside the contradictions of Afghan society, and I think a lot of that insurgent impulse is not about overthrowing the West or whatever. It's just local.
Is that – don't you hear that now in what the Secretary of Defense is saying, and even NATO, that they're going to focus on al-Qaeda? And elide the questions of the Taliban, maybe even have those discussions between Taliban and Karzai continue?
I do hear it, and I think that distinction has actually been in the wind for quite a while now. You know, there has been this struggle in American policymaking establishment between two things. One direction would be to just keep a small force there and go after individual people recognized as or identified by intelligence as being somehow like terrorists. The other impulse was go in there with a big force and protect the population and set up a civil society that works, and that will crowd out the terrorists. It's not a completely foolish idea. That makes a lot of sense. It just didn't work.
Why do you think it didn't work?
It didn't
culturally
work.
And historically, or
yeah, culturally and historically, it didn't work because within Afghan society, it was difficult, if not impossible, for American military folks to make the distinction between who they were protecting and who they were protecting them from. They looked the same, they talked the same language. Like, how do you tell the difference?
I'm sure you must have talked to American planners and people who looked at the way to fight insurgencies, and they must have heard that. They must have heard that that qualification, yet pursued this policy.
Well, I'm sure they heard that, and I will say this, that the problems in Afghanistan, the difficulties that have resulted there, I don't think you can easily say, oh, that's because a bunch of people made stupid decisions, and if only I had been in charge. It's not like that. In fact, no policy would have not resulted in some bad stuff, and no policy going forward will completely avoid some bad things happening. That's the first part of what you have to confront and accept. There's no completely perfect way through this.
Tamim Ansari is an Afghan scholar. He's also Afghan-American. He has written his latest book, is Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. The games being the games that Western powers were playing and Afghan leadership were playing.
There's two layers of games going on there.
Yeah. All right, I want to ask you about something you write about back to the British as a way of understanding women and that their role is in the future, the forward policy.
Mm-hmm.
Define the forward policy that the British put in place.
Well, that had nothing to do with women, although I did make a joke about that.
And I'm going to get to your joke.
The forward policy officially was the policy that the British policy that said instead of holding back and waiting for things to happen, if Russia is looming in the north, let's
this
go.
This is the 1840s.
This is the 1840s, 1870s again, 1880s. They said instead of just waiting for things to develop, let's move forward towards the Russian lines and put our barricade somewhere in Afghanistan right up against the Russians. Keep them back. The forward policy was active. You go in there and you make things happen.
And these were troops. These were Tommies that they were moving. These were the things that were moving that forward line.
Yes, that's right. And the two wars resulted from Britain deciding, okay, we have to govern from Kabul, and we have to put in the leader that we think will be completely pro-British. We can't trust somebody who has made themselves the leader of the Afghans. So they took out the guy that was there. They put in another guy.
All right. Well, you made the joke about the forward policy turning into fraternizing between men and women. But which gets me to the question of, I mean, these guys, these soldiers are moving around in Afghan society. And Afghan society, you say there's a public society and a private society.
That's right.
And the private society is where men and women interact, mm-hmm. or where women are more able to speak their minds. And then the public society, which is, as we understand it, where people are veiled and shadored and have to be subservient.
Yeah. And basically in that old Afghan society, the women were just weren't in public. They were in this private world. I also want to say, in the old days, you know, people said, well, what is it like growing up in Afghanistan? And I'd said, well, we all lived in compounds. And when we left the compound in a city, you're kind of like in a labyrinth amongst walls. There's nothing much to see. There's a bazaar, that's something. But for the most part, if you're in a neighborhood where people live, there's nothing there. It's just walls. When you go through one of those doors into a compound, all of a sudden there's a garden, there's a well, there's people, there's all stuff happening. That's where life is. That's the private world. That's, you know, the culture has an impulse to keep that away from strangers and outsiders.
Does that still exist?
It does, actually. But, you know, that's the struggle in Afghanistan. The fact that some part of the Afghan society and the Afghan soul wants to preserve that. And really, urbanization, modernization, development, and the outward policy, I would say, opening up to the world, it's not compatible with that. And so now there is a contradiction in Afghan society. It can't be resolved by going back to the past, I think.
So what are women's roles in resolving that in a positive, I guess, but maybe just resolving that?
Well, you know, in the period when I was growing up in Afghanistan and for maybe a couple of decades after I left in 1964, there was a steady progression towards a society in which women played a significant part in public life. And When you consider where Afghan society started out, what happened in the 50s and 60s and early 70s there, that's 25 years at most that you're talking about, to go from a society where women did not step out of the house. You know, my grandmother probably left her compound 3-4 times in the course of her life. To go from that within 10 years to a society where women were walking around in the streets unveiled, a few years later, they're going to university. A few years later, there's women doctors, teachers. They're announcing the news on the radio. They're working in offices. That's a lot of social change in a very short time. And that was done by Afghans in Afghanistan in a period when the outside powers were forced to negotiate with each other to keep a neutral Afghanistan. And it's that situation of neutrality and the absence of violence and war that allowed that kind of progress to happen. And it can happen again when there is a situation of, you know, neutrality. The outside powers have to negotiate with each other.
Who are the outside powers going to be after 2014?
Well, after 2014, there, even now, actually, China, Iran, India, and then the problematic Pakistan. Those are the main powers looming and getting ready to push into Afghanistan if there's a power vacuum.
So the U.S. and NATO's role is what?
The U.S. and NATO's role, I would say, is to treat Afghanistan as a problem globally, which requires a U.N. conference in which China, Iran, the U.S., and India and other powers. Actually, everybody's kind of associated with this, but I know it's a pipe dream. But agreeing to make Afghanistan have the status of a Central Asian Switzerland.
Ah, I see. That's your pipe dream. What's the reality? Because you do have in here, you know, you say the positive and negative in this book, Games Without Rules. You talk about, well, against the Taliban resurgence or the conservatism, there is the television shows. There are the outward-looking world views that people are expressing in not just Kabul, right?
Not just in Kabul. And I would say that with the proliferation of technology, with communication, you know, even in remote villages, people have television sets and satellite dishes. And those are people who are in their actual, you know, physical, empirical life, they're very exposed to mostly Talibanist attitudes and opinions. But the people who have brought those televisions to them are those same Taliban because they've traded them for drugs in some instances so they could sell them abroad and fund their insurgency. So it's I am enamored of the way that unexpected, unplanned things happen in history because of technology spreading and, you know, you can't scope out. It's not in anyone's power to control history.
Tamim Ansari has written Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. 12 years ago, 2001, Greg Mortensen handed me this Nelly's map of Afghanistan, and I keep pulling it out to look at it and read it. I'm going to be pulling it out after 2014, I think.
All right.
I think I'll have to. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you.
Tamim Ansari will be at Town Hall tomorrow night at 7:30. Tickets are $5. You can ask him about Reed College then, too. This is Weekday.
Good morning, it's 10:28. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. The apple never falls far from the tree, the saying goes, but what happens when it does? Later today, we'll find out what it's like for children whose identities are very different from their parents. For example, children who are born deaf or born with dwarfism. Andrew Solomon joins us. He's author of Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. He sits down with KUOW's David Hyde this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, dedicated to providing service for traveling families, including special meals, kids' kits full of surprises, and hundreds of on-demand entertainment options for young flyers. More at emirates.com/USA. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow.
Sunny skies, 44 degrees in Seattle. We're expecting sun all day, the high getting up to 47.
How are we doing at building up Seattle into a livable city? You can see that Ballard is exploding with apartments. Is the neighborhood getting better or worse with the big box buildings? A plan to build three towers at south end of Lake Union means some views blocked and new views created for sale. But will Mercer and Valley be good or bad streets for strolling? Cities are reshaping their streetscapes to become places for walking and sitting. Density is a positive for a lot of urban mayors. What has changed in our thinking about American cities, and more importantly, what are the next steps being considered to assure dense and vibrant places? Jeff Speck consults on those issues with many mayors of small cities around this country. He's written Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time. Though Speck would have worked too. Jeff Speck is a city planner based in D.C. He looks at the mix of uses of on the street to analyze how well it is serving walkers. One street in our city with a mix of cars and pedestrians is Pike Place. I asked him about it.
Well, Pike Place is one of these examples of why I had to write this book, because Pike Place is a mess. I mean, it is not does not look like a European plaza. It is not, you know, beautifully shaped by...
They're going to run you out of town.
It is not beautifully shaped by, you know, classically decorated buildings. It's as much a parking lot as it is as a street or a plaza, and it functions wonderfully because of the concatenation of cars and people and crowds and the way that everything mixes together there.
I thought that's what you said was good.
It is. No, absolutely. But it does not... If you were to look at a typical list of why people... You know, the typical list of what pedestrian advocates fight for in trying to make places more walkable, it is not Pike Place. Because Pike Place is not textbook beautiful or textbook accessible, right, in terms of how it's striped, the presence of all of this pedestrian-friendly things that you supposedly need to make a city work.
Well, so is that the counterintuitive success of the place, or is that something we should blow up and redo?
No, it is. My point is that if you create a place that has the right mix of uses and the right kind of concatenation of all the things that make up urbanity, then it will function very well, even if it doesn't meet the encyclopedia definition of pedestrian friendly.
Are you like giving up on small towns or suburban shopping mall oriented spaces?
Yes and no, in that order. Small towns are a perfect example of how you can have one wonderful main street that makes it have the pedestrian feeling, and especially because you get, I should say, let me phrase that more articulately, that makes it successful as a pedestrian place. I mean, small towns are along with villages and bigger towns and cities, are where the hope of walkability lies in America. It doesn't have to be a truly urban environment. However, there is very little you can do to post-1950s automobile-oriented infrastructure to make it walkable.
Really?
The blocks are just too big. The streets are too big. There's a wonderful book by my colleague, Galina Tacheva, that's called The Sprawl Repair Manual, that is worth looking at for some of the limited number of success stories that have been, battles that have been won. But it is so much easier to take a traditional American city, which still has what we call good bones, a nice porous network of small blocks, small streets. And by the way, your blocks out here on the West Pacific Northwest are among the smallest in the country. Fantastic. It's much easier.
But compared Portland to Seattle's blocks, aren't Portland smaller?
They are, but yours are almost as small. They're smaller than Oklahoma cities or smaller than Salt Lake cities, which are four times as big as yours are. The point is a traditionally organized community with streets and blocks and squares and buildings that shape those places is so ready to be retrofit to welcome walkability again, as opposed to the typical American post-war environment, which has grown up around the automobile and is very, very hard to fix.
Well, what does walkability mean to you? Because I'm coming back to the size again. Downtown Seattle is walkable,
mm-hmm.
But if I am a 78-year-old man,
mm-hmm.
and I live in the south end of downtown, I am not walking to the only grocery store. Well, there is a grocery store nearby anyways, but there's one.
Yeah, well, I mean, and again, I don't know Seattle well enough to talk about different parts of your downtown. But walkability means that there are parts of your city and hopefully enough of them so that those who wish to have that lifestyle can relocate there. What we see now is a huge influx into walkable communities of millennials who demand street life as something that they need, you know, to want to move to a place, and empty nesters who no longer need the big house, no longer need the yard, no longer need the school, and are selling their suburban homes like my parents just did and moving to a downtown core. It's what we call a NORC, a naturally occurring retirement community.
But will they have all the amenities they need? You said part of what makes a successful walkable city is mixed use, and by that you mean
right.
Part of it is interesting, right? So there's people working nearby.
Right.
There's people being able to shop nearby. Are there people doing reasonable construction nearby or reasonable industry nearby in a really good walkable city?
Well, as long as you have a good transit system that connects walkable nodes to each other, it isn't necessary to have everything in every place. What we see in most American cities, and again, the typical ones, not the Seattles, but the Cedar Rapids.
Boy, are they getting a rap.
Yeah, and it's a pretty nice city in terms of a very attractive downtown, but not one in which many people live. When you bring more housing downtown, that's when the other stuff comes.
By the way, why couldn't you take big shopping malls and plop housing into three quarters of those and cover up the parking lots?
I worked on just such a project in Miami, and what you do in those cases is you take a surface parking lot and you convert it to a structured parking lot, and then you can actually lay in a street network where that surface parking lot was. You can only do it when the economics are strong enough to support surface parking, which is perhaps $30,000 per car. So it has to be a really booming place like a, you know, South Miami or a Beverly Hills or something like that.
Why is that? I mean, if you bring a 20, if you put in, I don't know, 200 units and you bring in another 1,000 people, wouldn't that create a boom for that mall?
If the economics are such, it would certainly help the mall. But the economics have to be such that developers feel they can sell units that cost $20,000 to $40,000 more because of that parking space that you've had to build at great expense.
I see. And you have to usually build it because of just...
Well, if you're replacing a surface parking lot with other stuff,
right,
then where does that parking go and how do you park the other stuff? So I actually work on a lot of these suburban retrofit projects. And they rely on, I just did my second one, they rely on economics supporting structured parking.
Because in the end, people are still going to want to drive. They're forced to drive. There's not the other infrastructure.
There's a wonderful longer-term solution in which the introduction of transit makes that additional parking unnecessary. But right now, if you expect a free market developer to build housing in a principally automotive area, they're going to insist on 1 to 2 cars per unit.
Jeff Speck is author of Walkable City. By the way, what's the difference between walkable cities and smart growth?
Oh, dear. Well, my last book was called The Smart Growth Manual. So in this case, 2 years. But smart growth is a much more comprehensive discussion at the regional level about how we make our region more sustainable environmentally, economically, socially. Walkable city... I don't think anyone would disagree. Having a walkable city at the center of each metropolis is absolutely essential to achieving smart growth priorities.
It's the pod. It's one of the nodes that you have to create, right?
Yeah, I mean, smart growth essentially means that we're going to encourage people to live with the smallest possible footprint. And I don't mean square footage, but I mean, you know, climate change footprint. And the best way to do that, we've now learned beyond a doubt, is to bring them to a place where they don't need to drive all the time.
What's the role of tall buildings in a walkable city?
Tall buildings need to be tall enough to have enough people there so that the sidewalks can be lined with shops. Now, you don't need a shop-lined sidewalk for people to choose to walk, but the more of the ground level that is lined by shops, the more successful a walkable environment you'll have.
Because we want to be entertained while we walk.
Yes, stoops can be pretty and attractive, but people really, nothing is better than walking past the front of a store.
So you're talking here about tall buildings, if you follow the Vancouver model, skinny towers better than blocky towers.
Yeah, well, depending on who you talk to, you get a different answer on this. There are a number of very smart people like Christopher Alexander and Leon Creer who believe that anything, or Jan Gehl says anything above 5 stories should really be the the subject of discussion among the air traffic control authorities and not among the city planners, because they can't communicate with the people on the street. But I think most city planners will tell you that as long as the streets are shaped by buildings of adequate height to hold them, but not cast into deep shadow by giant slabs that don't allow you to see the sun, then whatever density is best supported by transit and best supports local shops is the right choice. And that leaves quite a broad range of choices available to most cities.
Well, I mean, once again, I'm applying it here. We have just redesigned a neighborhood mm-hmm. and moved a couple streets and cleared three big urban blocks that face a south end of a lake
okay.
and a big park. And now the question is, what's going to go in those three blocks?
Right.
There, the current design plan is for three pedestals mm-hmm. and then set back slightly two blocky towers, three uh-huh. blocky towers mm-hmm. of height, yep. 24 stories, I think it was. The original plan was two skinny towers.
Yeah.
And the difference among the critics is, well, the skinny towers at least would not have blocked the sun. But yep. a skinny tower to get that kind of economics has to go up probably twice as high?
Well, actually, you can't get the same economics with a skinny tower because you have to go up twice as high. This is the difference between Canada and America and why the Vancouver model is so lauded in America but not very often copied in America.
Because what are
they? Because developers are not used to spending as much as it takes per square foot to get a tall, skinny tower.
So what are they doing in Canada? Are they charging a lot of money for those upper apartments?
Yeah, you know, I'm not an expert, but I know that the expectations are different among the development community, and expectations are everything. People expect to make a certain amount of profit, and it's different in different places.
Oh, so it's not that they're charging more; it's that the developers are accepting less.
I suspect it's a little bit of both, but you know, it is very hard to get developers to do something different than what they made their last million doing.
Yeah, I guess so. So then what's the solution for that? What's the solution at the street level?
Well, the solution at the street level is always the same, which is to, with the exception of carefully shaped public spaces where you want to expand the outdoor space, to line roads with buildings up against the sidewalk edge so that you have that well-shaped street and that interest, something to look at as you walk by it. As you go up into the air, however, the amount of space that these buildings take, whether they're skinny towers or fat slabs, is principally going to be a function of what the city requires. Now, one thing I have learned, and I work for a lot of developers, or at least I used to before most of them stopped developing, is that one story less or one square foot less than what the developer wants will, quote, bankrupt the developer. That's their technique for getting what they want. In most cases, if you establish a protocol which is a little bit tougher, but it's universally applied so that no one gets a special deal, the developers will find a way to make it work, but they won't admit that until it's the law.
Do you think public-private spaces that are put off the city street help create a walkable and livable livable city, therefore a walkable city?
By off, do you mean against?
I mean only accessible to the people who are in that building, but the developer gets the right to go up because they've provided an amenity, even though it's just usually for the people who live in that building, or sometimes it's sort of a hidden amenity.
Are they interior or exterior?
Exterior or interior. Seattle has a few interior ones.
It's not something that I see very often in the places I work. I would say that, New York City allowed a lot of buildings in the 80s to go tall by having winter gardens on the ground floor, which were publicly accessible, but of course, well supervised, and didn't really encourage true freedom of expression and other things that happen. And I think most people feel they're not truly public spaces. I think that if a developer is asking for some concession in exchange for a public place, it should be a public place. But I would argue that most cities ask developers to make those places too big, and that the best public spaces are tight public spaces. Jan Gehl says, he describes how at a dinner party, if you have a skinny table, the conversation is much livelier because you can talk to the people across as well as on your right and left. And the same rule applies to public spaces. And I like to say tiny is tastier. They don't need to be big. They just need to be well-shaped.
Portland is full of public pocket parks.
Mm-hmm. I love pocket parks.
Yeah. Seattle doesn't have pocket parks. Instead, it has private spaces that are also public given through development credits.
Mm, interesting.
So I wonder if those then, because they're still private spaces, there's a regulatory and therefore sort of a less feeling of freedom in them.
Well, but then there's the example of Zuccotti Park, you probably heard about in New York, which was a privately owned, quote unquote, privately owned public space that it was determined was the ideal place to stage the Occupy New York movement because of the rules that applied that actually made it possible for them to stay longer because it wasn't a truly public space.
Yeah,
so I have to say, we have to read the fine print to find how to go on that one.
Jeff Speck is author of Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time. This is my, I have two last questions. One is a quick one. Is there a width of a sidewalk? Is there a rule of thumb?
The rule of thumb is that the sidewalk needs to be wide enough so there isn't congestion on it. But that might mean 6 or 7 feet. The main thing I would say here is that people often think wider sidewalks is the solution when, in fact, some of the most walkable cities in America, like New Orleans, have 7-foot wide sidewalks.
But they have a lot of people walking in the streets too, or what?
And some of them. You know, the streets that drunk people are sprawled out in. What's the name of that one? I forget the name of the
Bourbon.
Bourbon Street. Well named. But the typical street in the French Quarter, even if it's got cars in it, is a 7-foot sidewalk. But the sidewalks are protected by parked cars and by arcades and other things.
And that's part of what makes it useful.
Yeah, I mean, the byword is that the sidewalk needs to feel safe, and that is not necessarily a function of width.
And shouldn't Seattle, given that it rains so often here, have covered sidewalks downtown? Shouldn't every building be required to have awnings that connect so that I can always stay dry?
I like that idea as long as it does not take on an institutional quality where you have the same awning marching its way down streets that make the street feel like a mall of some sort or some larger kind of Big Brother zone. I think requiring new buildings to provide awnings over the sidewalk and ideally remove cloth awnings that you can crank forward and back would make a lot of sense as long as it's done on a merchant-by-merchant basis.
Why is a walkable city saving America? That seems like a pretty big claim.
We're running out of time, and that's the first half of my book.
But there are save three, America?
You asked, and I will answer. There are three fundamental crises we're facing right now that I believe, and I'm not the only one, that we are facing because of our automobile dependence. The first is an economic, more of a challenge than a crisis, that we're learning that we're much more productive when we come together in cities. And furthermore, that those cities that have reduced driving significantly, like Portland, where the typical Portlander drives 20% less than the typical American, is saving a tremendous amount of money into the local economy. It was calculated at about $3 billion that's being saved in the local economy every year by people not having to drive as much. So there's an economic argument. The second argument is a health argument. We are facing now the first generation of Americans who will not live as long as their parents. Most of that is due to illnesses that stem from excess weight. Everyone talks about diet, but what we're now learning is that inactivity is a much more important factor in our weight gain than diet. Study after study is now showing this. And the inactivity comes from a whole bunch of things, but essentially the fact that we have engineered out of our communities the useful walk so that we spend 2 hours a day that we might have once used to get around walking. We now are instead sitting during that time. Third is of course, as we experienced with Sandy, the climate change circumstance. And the big lesson, the big 180-degree shift in the outlook of the environmental movement, which used to be cities bad, countryside good, it's now understood. If you care about the countryside, if you care about nature, the best thing you can do is move to the city. You'll cut your carbon footprint in half. A great book on that is called Green Metropolis by David Owen. But the environmental movement, which used to be a back-to-nature Sierra Club kind of discussion, is now, and embraced by the Sierra Club as well, is now a back-to-the-cities movement.
Jeff Speck's an urban planner, works in Washington, D.C. He is author of Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Later, singer Michelle Ndege Ocello pays tribute to the late, great Nina Simone.
Oh, Lord, please don't let me be mad. misunderstood.
She was one of the people, but I felt she was like royalty.
An album dedicated to the sovereign soul of Nina Simone. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Sometimes. That story and much more today from 3 until 6:30.
Support for KUOW comes from Crispin Honeycrisp, unfiltered, cloudy, hard cider, naturally fermented using 100% Washington and Oregon unpasteurized, fresh-pressed apple juice and smoothed with organic honey. Crispin Honeycrisp, American craft cider.
We have sunny skies and 45 degrees in Seattle. Sun expected all day, the high reaching 47. It's going to be partly cloudy tonight with some patchy fog overnight, the low in the mid-30s.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Black Nativity this December 6th through the 23rd at the Moore Theater. Black Nativity features the poetry of Langston Hughes, the Nativity Band, and guest star B.B. Winans December 21st through the 23rd. Tickets at stgpresents.org.
This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scheer. Cairns are not just piles of rock. They reveal perhaps that somebody has passed by, but also a little bit about history and society. David Williams has been thinking about cairns, and he's written a book about it, The Art and Lore of Cairns. He is also the author of Seattle Street Smart Naturalist, Field Notes from the City, which we talked about. And he's written Cairns, Messengers in Stone. And hi, David.
Hi, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, since we could not meet in the field, I decided that while we are talking, we shall make a cairn.
Excellent. Oh, I wish I had known. I would have brought more rocks in.
Out of rocks. I felt 20 was a good number.
Okay.
First of all, what makes a good cairn?
What makes a good cairn? Well, one of the obvious things is being someplace where people can see them. This may sort of sound funny, but there's actually a guide written by the Appalachian Mountain Club, and the first thing they tell you is build a cairn in a conspicuous location. So I like to think of when you're building a cairn, think of it as Madonna or Lady Gaga. It's something that wants to be seen. You don't hide your cairns.
Don't hide your cairns. Now, you were writing about how sometimes you and your friends and others come across a cairn and they get mad and they kick it over. What up with that?
What up with that? Well, cairns have become, and actually have long been, a problem for many people. Some people take the attitude that, hey, if you're in the backcountry and you need a cairn, you're probably doing something wrong. You should be more aware of what's going on. Where I was mostly destroying them was when I worked for the Park Service in southern Utah, and people were building cairns in areas where they shouldn't, or in areas where it would lead people off paths in directions that maybe were beyond their abilities. So we took it from an aesthetic, an ecological, and also a cultural point of view. So it is problematic.
All right. I laid my first foundation on there of 5 rocks.
Excellent.
And they're sloping in because I believe that was one of the instructions in making a cairn from the book Cairns, Messengers in Stone.
That is true. You should have your batter for good stability. And as you said, batter is having it, the rocks tilt in towards the center, so gravity can do its thing.
Okay. Why in the world, we made a joke about this, that this was the perfect public radio topic, cairns, messengers in stone. But okay, I am grunting with you on this. Why are you thinking about these things to the extent that you wrote a book about them?
Well, sort of twofold. One is I have this geologic background and definitely view
the
world.
By the way, can you cairn and talk at the same time?
Try.
You got to do the next level
okay.
there.
So I view the world through a geologic lens, and this seemed another way to think about how people interact with the geologic world around them. And the second thing is that what I really discovered is that we have been building cairns for thousands upon thousands of years, and I would argue that cairns are one of our earliest forms of communication.
All right. Well, what is the oldest cairns that have been discovered
and dated? They find ones back 9,000 plus years. There's some in Rocky Mountain National Park that have been dated back towards that age. And those are pretty neat ones because they're cairns that they believe were used not necessarily to mark trails, but as game lines to direct animals to a certain point.
All right. Now, I'd never heard of the game line. That was an amazing thing. The Inuit were doing this as well.
Certainly. Yeah. And so, I mean, it makes sense. It's a way. One thing about a cairn is this idea that you can use it as something that stands for a person. In fact, the Inuit have a refer to these and have a specific name for cairns that actually stand in place of someone to represent someone, as opposed to just saying a direction or a place to go.
Well, that's an interesting idea. What's the notion in representing someone? Is that a cultural thing? Is that a religious thing, or is that just?
Well, with the Inuit, what's interesting is they
were, not easy, is it? By the way, it's already falling apart.
Yeah, this is a very precise, small scale cairn. The Inuit are doing it, at least in one place they did it. They were doing it to make to get animals used to a person being in that landscape, and so they were building them as basically the same height as a person. And so when the animals were feeding, they were used to this shape. And then when they would go hunt, the animals didn't necessarily. It's almost as if the cairns came to life, and they were able to take advantage of that.
That's wild. Did they also see it as a way to? I mean, they saw these lines as a way to guide the animals across the landscape.
Right.
And was that because the animals would see them as figures, something out of the landscape, or a figure, or humans, and
something different in the landscape instead of what they maybe had been used to cruising along, and they had always seen an open landscape. All of a sudden, there was something there that was directing them, and sometimes they would actually decorate the cairns with, or Inukshuk as they're calling them, they decorate them maybe with caribou antlers or something, or feathers that would swing in the wind to add that additional aspect of motion and sort of human-like nature.
What's the most interesting cairn that you came across in your studies?
Well,
you went all over the world in research to look at these things.
I thought about it all over, and I guess my favorite cairn that I came across was one in Iceland, and it was more fact that it was its geologic location in the valley called Thingvellir. It's the one spot on Earth where two of the plates of plate tectonics come up to the surface, and they're actually pulling apart at this point. So you can start on one side of the valley, follow a series of cairns across the valley, and in that 3-mile walk, you're basically going from America all the way to Europe, at least geologically. And I just thought the connection, being this uber geology geek, that was my favorite. Those are my favorite cairns. It wasn't one, it was many.
Because this is about geology and the rocks that are used. But you also point out cairns that are used to contain messages, cairns that have been used for burial sites. So it is the oldest form of communication in many ways that we still have, because it's stone.
Right, it's stone, it's simple, and I mean, there is something about rock, I think, that people get excited by or can connect to. There's no persona to it. We can really give it any attribute we want, and I think that basic connection to our planet is something that I think it's sort of inherent in humans. I mean, we have this deep, deep connection, whether it's something like a cairn or my other sort of topic of interest, building stone, is that people recognize when they see this that it's of the earth. It's there's something that connects to place. And that's really, for me, a very important aspect of the geologic world, is thinking the connections that people make to the place around them through the rocks that they use.
Think anybody will knock our cairn over?
No, they might. She's not going to sneak in.
I think they'll leave it.
Yeah.
All right, one last thing on cairns. You see them all over now. When I go to a beach, people are drawn to them. When you look at an artist like Andy Goldsworthy, he's made a career out of stacking rocks.
Right.
What's going on?
I think it's Andy Goldsworthy's fault, if you will. And maybe not fault, or his magic, in the sense that he realized the potential of rock or stone as a medium to build with. And once he did it, people started to be amazed by it. And whenever I talk about stone in terms of cairns for my book tour, people ask about that, this, you know, what is it with everyone building them? And a person in the audience said, well, I was walking along and I came across all these little piles, and I thought it was pretty neat, and I wanted to be part of that. So I think it's become this just cool thing. So people do it.
David Williams is author of Cairns, Messengers in Stone. Weekday today is Katie Sewell, Jason Bogano, Brian Buckaloo, Amina Asadi, Alexander Garrettin, Danielle Anthony Goodwin, Andy Hurst. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. I'm Steve Scherr.
Good morning. It's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News are coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from UW College of Education in conjunction with the Danforth Leadership Program, recruiting educators to join a leadership development program. Information session November 27th, UW Campus, Miller Hall. Details online at education.washington.edu/Danforth.
This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from the School of Teaching ESL, presenting an information session on training options to...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.